This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Our buzzword for today is... cravings! Cravings! We're talking cravings. What foods do we get cravings of?
Chocolate?
Chocolate, yes. Well done, chocolate.
Yes, if we weren't fat enough from last week's chocolate episode, we do need to continue today, and joining us in the studio for that discussion will be Kristen Tibbles from the Savour Chocolate School and Patisserie. We're also speaking today to Morris Esposito. He is the chef and owner of Esposito's in Carlton. He's going to talk to us about sustainability and all of those things that are involved in managing your carbon footprint, as well as acknowledging his cultural heritage. We'll have some fantastic music, and we're going to learn a little bit about low-alcohol wine. You may, like me, ask the question, why low-alcohol wine? Ben Haynes, who was the 2008 Young Winemaker of the Year, is going to talk us through that. But first, in a new segment for Cravings, welcome aboard, we're going to have a look at some foodie news. Earlier this week, the Australian Gourmet Traveller Awards were announced, and only one restaurant out of the top 10 came from Melbourne, which was Shannon Bennett's Vue du Monde. Aged food critic Mac Preston and MasterChef judge, as well as the food critic, says we shouldn't feel snubbed, and that it's understood that we have fewer top-end restaurants than Sydney. My personal feeling, I disagree, but I'm hoping that we can talk to Anthea Lucas from Australian Gourmet Traveller in the next couple of weeks. We did have another, I don't know, seven or eight in the top 20. The Bait and Pal Hotel. Some of you may know the Bait and Pal on Victoria Parade in Collingwood as a dirty old boozer. It's gone through a 10-month renovation, which General Manager Anton Fort says was torturous, and has now turned into a very groovy little classic old-style pub. Chef Raymond Larkins, who was formerly at Seamstress and Lardro, is in charge of sharing that menu, so that's probably somewhere we can get along to. You also may remember Zoe Roy from this show just a couple of weeks ago when we were celebrating the contribution of women in the industry. Zoe is leaving the Commoner and heading back to WA, where she's going to, with her partner, open a bar and restaurant in Fremantle, which is, as she describes it, as a bar with good food. Enough of the foodie news. We need to talk to some fabulous folks sitting in front of me. If you would like to interact with the program today, do SMS us on 0427JOY949. You can phone 96992949 and speak to Heath. Or you can email us on air at joy.org.au. I'd really like to know where you're listening from today, and I do have to send a special cheerio to a couple of folk who are driving around McLaren Vale in South Australia, Amanda Glenn and Georgie Hello. Speaking of hellos, there's a young woman sitting in front of me with a box full of chocolate. It's not like we didn't have enough last week. Kristen Tibbles, welcome to our little Cravings MasterChef kitchen, as we call it.
Thank you.
And Morris Esposito from Esposito's in Carlton, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Guys, I wanted to talk to you about a whole variety of things today, and some of them do meld. But first, Morris, let's talk about you. You've been doing this for 20-odd years?
Yeah, 21 years.
Give us the Twitter version of your career to date.
Fell into it and fell in love with it.
That's 140 characters. That's exactly what I asked for. Where did you develop this love? You come from an Italian background?
Yeah, mum cooked professionally for a long time, and she imparted a love affair with food. I didn't really enjoy food as a little child, mm-hmm. And then just grew into it. Played tennis professionally.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, yeah. That didn't go all that well.
No Wimbledon titles?
No, none of that. No, just not good enough. And then took up my apprenticeship, started with Stephanie Alexander, and...
It's not a bad start.
Yes, well, it was a fantastic start. And just one thing led to another, and passion took over.
And so from places like Il Baccaro and Sarti, you also worked in London to...
Pied de Terre.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing place. Crazy, but amazing.
Is that Marco Pierre Wise?
No, his name was Richard Nee at the time.
Right, okay, yeah. Very good, very good. And Kristen, how did you come to be doing what you're doing at the Savour Chocolate School and Patisserie?
I used to travel a lot demonstrating to other pastry chefs and chefs throughout the world demonstrating chocolate,
mm-hmm.
And felt there was a real lack of skill in Australia, so decided to open Savour in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And we have about 40% international students now, and the rest are from interstate and Melbourne.
And what am I going to learn at Savour?
We do hands-on classes. We do both patisserie and chocolate. A lot of people have come to either open a chocolate business or they've just come for a fun afternoon to make chocolates and make themselves sick with as much as they could possibly eat.
I was asking the three European fellows that were in here last week who are all chocolate specialists, and I want to get your opinion because it's, first of all, you're not a man, and secondly, you're not European. What's the seduction with chocolate?
I think it's very versatile, but it's something that appeals to most people. And it is an aphrodisiac. It releases endorphins, which make you feel good. So
how does that result in it being an aphrodisiac?
It makes you feel good, so it replicates a feeling of love. So, and it's proven that it was actually used as an aphrodisiac. I did a test actually with the television show What's Good For You. We did a trial to see if it was an aphrodisiac, and they concluded that it was.
I'm somebody who doesn't like a lot of chocolate. Does this make me an unhappy person?
No, I think it means maybe you haven't got a sweet tooth, but I think there's always a chocolate that suits everybody.
Very good. Morris, are you a chocolate fan?
No, yeah, I enjoy chocolate.
Do your kids, because you've got two fabulous little kids, are they chocolate fans?
One's a sweet tooth and one's not, yeah.
Are we allowed to say hello to them on air?
Of course. Yeah.
Hello, Iris. Hello, Jack. There you go.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about sustainability because you've sort of refashioned your menu and everything you do at Esposito to, mm-hmm. to be really considerate of a carbon footprint and, mm-hmm. and what you contribute ecologically. Talk me through a little more about what that lightning bolt decision was to make the change.
It wasn't a lightning bolt, far from it. I suppose... Going back to my heritage, Mum and Dad always ate what was in season, what was there and then available. And I suppose that's really carried on into my career as a cook, is that I only try and buy what's in season. With the sustainability angle, it's something that I completely fell into. So it was buying John Dory that was a certain size,
mm-hmm.
I didn't realise I was doing the right thing, but I just thought this is what Mum and Dad and my teachers taught me in the industry. So sustainability was something that just came along by chance, but I didn't realise I was doing the right thing.
Mm. I want to talk about travelling miles, but first we do need to take a short break. You're listening to Cravings on Joy 94.9. My name is Pete Dillon. We have received a couple of messages. Well, one message. Thank you for the shout-out to folk who are travelling around the McLaren Vale, currently in Wollongong. So Amanda, Glenn and Georgie, enjoy. Just before we heard from our community service sponsor announcements, we started this conversation about carbon footprints, and I want to bring you into this, Kristen, because you're an ambassador for Calibo Chocolates from Belgium.
Yes, that's right.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Very good. Is there a consideration, or do we have a product in Australia that is as good as Calibo? A, if not, why not? And B, is it a consideration that we're spending a lot of time and energy importing good chocolate when we could potentially be making our own?
We don't have a locally manufactured chocolate that would compare to Calibart chocolate.
Why not, do you know?
I think when you look at it, Calibart as a group, the Barry Calibart group, are the biggest chocolate company in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Every one in four chocolates consumed is manufactured by that company around the world. It's very difficult for people locally to compete on that level and be able to maintain a quality and meet the same price point, even as an imported product.
Mm-hmm.
We do grow cocoa in Australia.
Right.
So that's quite new to Australia. So I think in the future that will slowly change. We will start to see some really beautiful quality chocolates coming through. But at the moment, there's really nothing that's up there at that quality.
And hence, that's why we have to import Belgian chocolate. I think last week we spoke, there was something like 170,000 tonnes of chocolate made in Belgium every year, which equates to about 85 Boeing 747s. Now, that's a hell of a lot of chocolate. How important is it to have good quality chocolate here for what you do?
It's very good quality. I think Australian palates are changing dramatically as to what they want to consume. There's two main types. There's compound chocolate and couverture. So compound is made with trans fats, which you really want
bad
to avoid.
Stuff,
really
right,
bad for
yeah.
you. Our bodies can't process it. Couverture chocolate is increasing by about 2 to 3% per year. So that's changing as well. And previously, we didn't really have the demand for the couverture chocolate that we've now got, which has been created probably over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I think every guest that we've had on this program over the past, I don't know, 6 or 7 episodes has talked about how much things have changed over the last 10 years. When we were talking earlier about artichokes, for example, how much are we now producing that we perhaps didn't even 10 years ago? And how much is this changing the landscape as far as importing and using Australian products?
I think that for Australian chefs that really are consumed about producing things on their own, it has changed quite dramatically. I can speak for myself. When I have the option to purchase Australian, I always do, or I produce it myself.
Is that at the sacrifice of you making money?
Yes, sometimes.
How do you then balance that? You're obviously in business to make money.
Mm-hmm. It's an ethical issue for me. It's about if you're flying the flag of sustainability on fish, you can't be purchasing Italian artichokes in Italian extra virgin olive oil when we've got it all here. So it's ethical.
That's an interesting story. Artichokes, you can buy a tin of in olive oil or marinated in brine for X amount of dollars, and to buy an artichoke here is going to cost you
$2.50 per artichoke plus oil, so $3.20.
And then your time on top of that, rather
of
than opening a can, you've got to then poach them and marinate them. And
But as we were talking about, guests do really appreciate the fact that you're doing things properly and you're actually doing something that is local. My guests do anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So taking that into consideration, you're using Western Plains pork?
Yes. Yep. Again, ethical, people, they're happy pigs.
Mm.
They're
very tasty pigs.
And they're tasty pigs too.
I'm a very big fan of Western Plains pork. And again, the sustainable seafood, and you also have a certification. Talk me through this, Angus certified.
Black Angus certification is basically, again, flying the flag for a consistency of product. For years, I went through the whole process of buying all sorts of meat. Black Angus is a brand, maybe like Calibo, very large place that does lots of beef, processes properly, and again has a sustainable angle. So it is lot fed and grain fed, mm-hmm. but only up to 150 days.
So these are happy cows as well.
Happy food, happy people.
What sort of difference does it make to the taste of food when you're using stuff that is so fresh and so locally produced?
I think it makes a huge difference. I think it makes the way things are produced and the way things are looked after is amazing. I mean, Barramundi 10 years ago was muddy, smelt of tea tree oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can buy gorgeous Barramundi from Humpty Doo and it doesn't taste... It tastes like wild.
So is there still, I guess, some consideration in that Humpty Doo is just outside of Darwin?
Yep.
We've still got to get that down fresh.
Yes.
Obviously, we're not...
Not flying it from the other side of the world.
True, and we're also not taking stuff from the waters where this is, I'm assuming, farmed Barramundi?
That's right, yep. Yeah, aquaculture opposed to pond culture.
Does that... Sorry, I just want to keep going back to this, how it affects... Or how it changes the taste of a barramundi that is wild fished as compared to something that's farmed.
I think it's all in texture. I mean, really, to sum it up in not many words, texturally, a wild barramundi has done a considerable amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
A farm barramundi has done a lot less work, so it's just chilled out in a pond.
And is that the same for things like oysters? I'm just trying to think what else we farm seafood-wise.
Scallops.
Mud
crab. There's a whole heap of things that we do go out and we do farm.
My name is Pete Dillon. The show is Cravings, and with me still is Morris Esposito from Esposito's in Carlton and Kristen Tibbles, who has just thrust at me a magnificent box of handmade chocolates, which we'll talk about post-program, I think. Well, I just want to finish this discussion about how you, when you're fashioning a menu, and obviously you do that seasonally, how you then take all these considerations into place, that you've got a profit margin you want to achieve, that you've got sustainability issues and carbon footprint that you want to consider. You've got a bunch of wine sitting there that you still need to obviously match. How do you balance all of that, working 7 days a week and being a dad of two lovely little kids?
It depends on who you talk to. I suppose it's a challenge. 2 years into the restaurant, it's been a challenge, and getting the balance is something that we're working on. So I haven't got that balance yet, but we're achieving it slowly.
Because you work about 16 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
which is not good for any human being,
mm-hmm.
7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
When's the downtime? When's the time to sit down and think about new ideas, new methods, new marriages in food?
It happens. It does. The day is not completely full of just go, go, go. And you build a repertoire of being able to think through dishes when you're actually preparing during the day and even in the evening. So over a quiet beer, you can, think of things to do for the following day. And obviously speaking to your fishmonger, your butcher, your greengrocer, that's where you get your inspiration from, because that's where it all stems from.
And that, of course, is the same with consumers, that they need to create a relationship with somebody who sells them fish and sells them meat and sells
That's
them
right.
their fruit and vegetables.
People come in and they want the same thing. A lot of customers want grilled John Dory, and that doesn't always happen there at the restaurant, because sometimes the Dory is not available, so we just don't buy it. Or it's too small, we don't buy it. It's not about just feeding people what they want to eat, it's feeding people what we can give them with a sustainable angle.
Look, I know you have to run off because you do have a restaurant to run. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us in the Cravings MasterChef Kitchen,
pleasure.
As we call
it. Great fun.
And we will meet your wife in a couple of weeks, I believe, when she comes in with La Luna's Adrienne Richardson to talk about her book Fish. Mo, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Morris Esposito from Esposito's in Carlton. You can get out their corner of Drummond and Elgin Streets. There is the shameless plug. Great food, open 7 days a week, so check it out at espositofood.com.au. EspositoFood.com. Sorry, there you go, no AU, he says as he's rushing out the door.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Well, thank you, Kristen. Back to you. We've gone through main course. We've eaten some sustainable fish. We've eaten some pork from Western Plains. We've got some Angus beef. We're going to move on to dessert. And this is really hard talking about visual stuff when it's not in front of people. But some of these chocolates have got beautiful reds and yellows and oranges in them. How do you get these chocolates to look like this?
In Australia, we actually incorporate quite a lot of colour, and I think that's because a lot of the chocolate businesses here are more artisan-style businesses. They're not huge, so they have the time to do it because it's very time-consuming. So a lot of it's applied with cocoa butter, which is the fat from the cocoa bean, And that is what gives you the shine as well. So we put a bit of oil-based soluble colour in there.
Yeah.
And then you can apply it many different ways. You can spray it or flick it or...
Is this done with... we can't call it white chocolate because it technically is not chocolate.
That's right. It's a confection.
Right. So this is done with white confection.
It's done with pure cocoa butter on the surface to create the colour.
Right.
And then we back it with white chocolate to maintain some of that colour.
Sure. So clearly if people want to learn to make their own handmade chocolates, they can come out to, sorry, he reaches across, to Savour, where you do boutique classes, short courses. Do you do longer courses?
The longest we do is 5 days, but all our classes are consecutive. So you can do level 1 to 4 in gâteaux. You could do level 1 to 4 in chocolate making. And that's because people come for different reasons. As I said, some people come because they're looking at entering the industry or buying a business. Other people just love food and have a passion and want to learn to create things for their own pleasure.
So are we going to see you as a potential contestant on MasterChef in years to come?
I don't think I'd qualify. Yes.
Oh, actually, no, of course you don't, because you've got a qualification. The MasterChef phenomenon, which we talk about probably every week, was interesting in that people are now starting to pay attention far more to food than perhaps we did. Is that your take on it?
I thought it was fantastic for the industry. I think people really did pick up on the different products. We have a retail shop as well where we sell equipment, and we would have people coming in saying, I want everything I need to create that cake.
Right, which is, you need Matt Moran, essentially, don't you?
Yes.
For those three of you that didn't actually watch MasterChef, we are talking about the final night between Poe and Julie where we learnt, and it probably came into the popular vernacular, talking about tempered chocolate.
Yeah, which is one of the most skillful things in terms of patisserie to actually be able to achieve. It's not difficult when you know what you're doing, but if you don't know what you're doing, it's very challenging.
And this is where we saw Poe perhaps make the fatal error that she tried to cut a few corners. Hey, Jack, listening in, I think, Adelaide, thank you for your several messages and that lovely compliment on Somewhere Over the Rainbow from Melody Gardot. It is indeed a beautiful song. How do you, Kristen, keep coming up with new ideas for chocolate? How do you come up with new ideas for fillings? We did meet some guys last week, one of which had put some white Italian truffle into a chocolate truffle, and let me tell you, they were just spectacular because I love Italian truffle. How do you keep coming up with ideas to fill these little sort of cases?
I compete internationally or manage the Australian pastry team.
Yep.
So we're constantly challenging the boundaries of what we can actually do to create something that internationally is recognised as something spectacular. So doing that, although it's a lot of hours, determines what you actually put into the products and enables you to create new things. I also write for an American and Asian magazine with a recipe every issue. So
this is a chocolate-focused magazine?
It's actually a patisserie magazine, and I actually do entremet, which is a cake, every issue.
Yep.
So that forces me. You don't want to put something in there because it's a professional magazine that other professionals are going to say, oh, what was she thinking? So I sort of push myself there to create new things.
The voice you can hear is that of Kristen Tibbles from the Savour Chocolate School and Patisserie. Chocolate and Patisserie School, perhaps, might be the better way to put it. In where are you based?
In Brunswick, just in Wilson Avenue.
There was a young fellow on, a cocktail guru, a couple of weeks ago, talking about cocktails and how being able to buy new citrus and finger citrus and interesting things that are grown here in Australia makes a difference to the way that they come up with new methods and ideas for cocktails. Is it the same with chocolate?
Yeah, there's lots of new products, ingredients that we're incorporating that really change the eating experience.
What are some of those new ingredients?
We're using a lot of native bush foods like mountain pepper, bush tomato.
With chocolate.
There's a beautiful as well river mint tea that's an indigenous product as well, which is stunning and really complement the different chocolates. We pick a chocolate that actually matches the flavour perfectly.
Right.
And then we create something with that.
So what would you put with a bush tomato? I'm a little intrigued. My eyes did sort of...
Bush tomato almost has a caramelised sort of flavour to it, slight acidity, but really caramel undertone. So we think that it's a really warm flavour. So we put that with a nice milk chocolate and maybe incorporate that into an actual caramel filling.
Yum, yum. And the mountain pepper? Again, pepper is not something that I would immediately click and go, yeah, let's put that with chocolate.
That is divine. The mountain pepper that we have is actually grown amongst lavender.
Right.
So it has a slight aftertaste of a lavender flavour in it as well, which is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And we blend that with a really, really intense dark chocolate. We've got a 75% cocoa that's from Tanzania, and that's a divine match for the mountain pepper.
Dark chocolate goes really well with meat as well. I've been banging on a couple of, well, last week in particular, about venison that has a grated, I think it's 85% cocoa chocolate. Why does that work for me?
Because it has very little sugar, and now you can actually buy chocolates where they're not blended, so the beans aren't blended, so the beans are actually from one particular country,
mm-hmm.
or even from one farm. So the flavour profile is so much more intense. So you can get cocoa that's grown amongst tobacco or cocoa that's grown amongst bananas, and it'll actually adopt part of that flavour, which will come through in the end chocolate. So if you've got a chocolate with very little sugar in it, it's a perfect match for sort of game meat. That style of product goes beautifully.
Wow. Now it is time for a shameless plug about the Shaver. Shaver. There's a Freudian slip. The Savour Chocolate and Patisserie School. So how do people get in touch with you? There's clearly a website.
The website's savourschool.com.au. And we open 7 days a week. So we run classes 7 days and nights.
So if you're sitting at home salivating and you've decided you are in need of some quality chocolate made with Belgian Calibo chocolate, you can jump on your push bike, your car, your horse, pop out to Wilson Street in Brunswick.
Yeah, Wilson Avenue.
Sorry, Wilson Avenue in Brunswick. And seriously, check out some of these delectable chocolates because they look magnificent.
Thank you.
And I am sure they taste magnificent. Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to have you in our little MasterChef studio here. And right now I've got another new song for you. Every Saturday I generally do this show mildly hungover, which means that I get a little afraid of Fridays. We're talking about chocolate that's lacking in sugar, and we're now going to address the idea of wine that's perhaps lacking in a bit of booze. Joining me on the line is the 2008 Wine Society's Young Winemaker of the Year. He's a winemaker at Mitchelton Wines in Central Victoria. Ben Haynes, good afternoon.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's are you inside a water tank or a wine vat?
Not currently. I'm out amongst the vodkas in Central Victoria, so forgive me if I drop out.
Stop right there. Wherever you are, just stop, because we've now got a good line. First of all, congratulations on your award last year for the Mitchelton Wines. I want to talk about low-alcohol wine because it's something I don't understand.
Sure. It's probably something that a lot of people are struggling to understand, but it's probably something that we started with the idea of low-alcohol wines this year, I guess in response to the market that was kind of requesting wines that I suppose were for well-being and for people who wanted to get, drink wine guilt-free, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the whole idea of making these wines that people can drink and do a good thing for.
Ben, I'm having a lot of trouble with your line here, mate, which is a bit of a bother. Let's try just for a bit longer and see if we can get you in one spot that works. Several years ago, Lindeman's Early Harvest launched their low-alcohol wines with former Olympic swimmer Gian Rooney. Has that been an impetus to sort of follow that lead?
Yeah, I guess Lindeman's were the first, really, to open up the market there. They've certainly got quite a presence in the market. We feel that we've kind of just hit the curve. It's something that's kind of really, really kind of hit its straps in the last kind of 12 to 24 months. And I suppose our approach with the low alcohol wines is it's quite easy to look at a low alcohol wine as being something that is maybe less quality. And our approach is more to say, okay, you can actually exploit the benefits of having lower alcohol in your wines because it actually offers up some purity and things like that in the wine. So yeah, we've kind of just taken a different approach.
Does it affect the characteristic of the wine? Because I think part of the structure of wine is that it does contain a certain percentage of alcohol, which lends itself to its character and its structure. How different is wine that is low in alcohol?
That's very true. The alcohol does have quite an impact on flavour impression and also aromatically. So, the presence of alcohol does actually help to lift the fruit characters out of the glass, and it also has an impact on the body of the wine. I guess the approach with low alcohol wines is that if you're clever in the sourcing of your fruit and you use fruit that has really good fruit weight and fruit intensity, then you're not actually compromising the wine. So what, in fact, the approach that we're taking is that you actually, by having lower alcohol levels, you're actually exposing the purity of the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess on the palate, you're experiencing more of a delicateness, I guess. It's not quite as heavy, and it's not quite as full. It's kind of a bit more delicate, but certainly all the flavours still, if you use good fruit and you pick it at the right time, you're certainly experiencing all the flavours.
Are there certain fruits that do, in fact, lend themselves better to a lower alcohol wine?
Absolutely. You need to be very careful about which varieties you use for these wines. So we have three wines in the lower alcohol range for Price. A Semillon Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
Also have a sparkling, which is Chardonnay dominant, and also have a little bit of Riesling and a little bit of Marsan. And we also have a Moscato. So two out of those three wines, particularly the sparkling and the Semillon Sauvignon Blanc, are using varieties that can be picked quite early without any compromise to the flavour profile.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at something like Semillon, you can pick that really, really early, and what that means is that by picking early, you have lower sugar levels in your juice that becomes wine, and therefore when you ferment that through, you're ending up with a lower alcohol level. So hence the Lindeman's Early Harvest title. So,
mm-hmm.
Very much about using the right varietals and picking quite early.
But traditionally, Semillon is a wine that has, if you'll pardon the expression, quite a bit of balls about it.
Yeah.
And certainly those that are produced out of places like the Hunter Valley in New South Wales that are known for their Sems. How do you know when the fruit is ready to be picked early? Is it because of season? Is it because of the way that the fruit's treated on the vine?
Yeah, there's probably two things that we look at there. The first thing is getting out in the vines and actually tasting the fruit. And the first thing that we're looking for is the flavour profile, which you can really see in the fruit and by chewing the skins. So you're looking for Semillon, you're looking for, particularly with a blend of Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc, you're looking for, I guess, more of kind of freshly cut grass, that summer lawn type character in your mm-hmm. Semillon. And also knowing that when you add your Sauvignon Blanc into the program, you're going to get that lovely kind of tropical background.
Yep.
So you're really looking for that in your fruit. The other thing that we're looking for very much is acid. The style of these wines is very much about freshness and kind of dry and crisp. So you're really looking for highlights of acidity, but also the flavour profiles that you're looking for. So, again, it comes back to choosing varieties that are suitable, and Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc go very, very, very well together.
Moscato I've been talking about for years as a breakfast wine, and at only 6% alcohol, it's not like it's going to get you half as drunk as a 12% alcohol wine. The lower the percentage of alcohol in a wine, the more sort of incremental the decrease in you getting a bit over-refreshed and giggly. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I guess that's fair. Moscato is a little bit of a different one, actually. Of the three wines, that's the one that isn't actually an early harvest. You actually harvest the Moscato at full ripeness, but what you're actually doing is stopping your fermentation early so that you're harnessing quite a bit of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So, that is a little bit of a different situation. You are at 6% alcohol. I think it works out to be about 3.2 standard drinks, 750ml bottle.
Yep.
It's I guess you're replacing the giggle from the alcohol with a bit of a giggle from the sugar you're going to get, I guess.
Which is not entirely a bad thing, I'm sure. Ben, who's the market? Who are you selling low alcohol wines to? Who drinks them?
Look, to be frank, it has been targeted very much at I guess the cafe scene, certainly at the female market as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just spending a little bit of time out in the market and in the trade and talking to people. Particularly the Moscato has been very, very successful in the kind of cafe scene as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mothers that like to get together with their babies and have a few drinks mid-afternoon without feeling like they're kind of doing the wrong thing. and it's also very much appealing to young people. I guess, you know, parents who are throwing 18th birthday parties for their kids that maybe want an offering that's probably not going to necessarily get everyone smashed. I think it appeals to a reasonably broad market, but certainly, yeah, the younger market, and particularly the kind of the female market as well.
And, of course, our program here, Cravings, at Joy 94.9, we don't encourage any sort of binge drinking or irresponsible consumption of alcohol.
No, not at all. And as a representative of Mitchelton Mines, I would agree with that strongly.
Now, Ben, Mitchelton's got a couple of little events coming up, a black tie dinner and a picnic in the vines to celebrate 40 years. I can't believe it's 40 years of Mitchelton already. Do you want to quickly pop in a little plug for those events?
Yeah, sure. 40 years ago, Mitchelton planted the first vines up here in central Victoria, and this next weekend we're actually celebrating that. So we have a black tie dinner event on the Saturday night, and then on the Sunday we have what we're calling the Picnic in the Vines, which is a day out. It's actually Father's Day. It's a day out which runs from, I think, 11 till 4 on Sunday, next Sunday, and it's going to be a day of tasting. There'll be some tours, there'll be some live music, there'll be some food, and a really good chance just to talk with myself and the other winemakers about some of the things that we're doing at Mitchelton and reflect upon the last 40 years.
Excellent. Ben, look, we wish you continued success with Mitchelton and as such a young man making some fairly cracking wines, certainly with the challenges of a low alcohol wine. We wish you continued success at Mitchelton, and I hope to get up there and see you. It certainly won't be next weekend, I'm afraid. I've got a little radio show to do next Saturday. So,
sure, no, absolutely. Thanks for your time, and we hope to see some of the listeners up at Mitchelton next weekend.
Good on you, Ben. That's Ben Haynes, 2008 Wine Magazine Young Winemaker of the Year, talking low alcohol wines. I've had a message from Grant. He'd like to hear more about making pastries, that is, croissants, etc. Likes to cook at home and wants to experiment more. Grant, I will endeavour to get a pastry chef in the next 3 or 4 weeks so that we can talk about those things. It's currently about 2:03. We don't have long to go on the show. Coming up in the next, probably in about the next month, you're going to meet some amazing folk from this industry. You'll meet Stephanie Alexander. She is essentially the godmother of the industry here in Melbourne and has been around for decades, shaping the careers of many young folk in Melbourne. Adrian Richardson, who I mentioned before, is the chef at La Luna. He does amazing things with meat and has a book titled Meat. He'll talk to us in late September. Pete Evans, who a lot of you might recognise from TV, he's going to come and talk barbecues with us and the basics of your grill. And for those of you that watch a little bit of lifestyle television, you may have heard of Fast Ed. He is Ed Helmaggy. He will actually join us next week on Cravings. Pop into your diary in a couple of weeks. We'll be doing a show from 2 until 3 because of an outside broadcast for, I think it's Leather Pride. It's a leather event. That's on Saturday the 19th of September.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.